And I understand in late 1968, the band makes a connection with local record producer Warren Kendrick. What's the story on that?
Yes, we got together with Warren to practice for an album that he was going to be producing of all our original material. And we got together with him at someplace else in Robbinsdale. It was a club that had been sitting for a while, and they had the stage and all that. So we went in there, we were rehearsing, we had all our stuff set up, and after a couple of nights of rehearsing there, we'd left one night and found out that the place had burned down that night. Lost everything, $20,000 worth of equipment gone in one night, and that was Park Music's equipment.
Was the equipment insured?
No.
So who was supposed to replace the equipment?
We went back to Park Music and told them the story, and they contacted Sun and said that one of the bands that they were supporting had lost all their equipment in a fire. So they said, bring all the equipment back to our factory and we will replace it. So me and Frank Cox loaded up everything into the van, drove all the way to Portland, Oregon, brought the stuff back to the factory, set it on their dock, and waited 2 days. And finally they said, no, we have problems, so why don't you guys head back to Minnesota? So we led back to Minnesota without equipment, and it was never replaced.
That's a long way to drive.
We drove all the way out there and all the way back and had nothing. So we came back, and Mort and Leo felt bad about the whole thing, so they set us up with Custom, which was another one of their sponsors. They'd contacted them and says, would you support this band and give them all their equipment, all their PA stuff? We used Custom for one night and gave it back to them and said, we can't do it.
Why?
It just didn't sound right. It wasn't right at all. And what happened then, I think we went to Torps Music in South Minneapolis and ended up with Marshall. Lonnie got a couple of Marshalls, and I got a couple of Marshalls. But we had a big tab we had to pay on that one, which after a while got repossessed and called back.
I'm getting confused between the fire and the truck accident.
Oh,
didn't
the truck accident.
Did they fix things for the fire, but not for the truck? Or did they fix it for the truck and not for the fire?
You're right. There was a truck accident after the fire. We lost it again. And then we rolled.
Because I was jealous. They got fixed, but nobody fixed me.
Yeah.
So you got a new set of drums at some point?
No.
Well, I did, but I didn't have insurance to cover it.
You had to buy a new set of drums.
Yeah.
What did you buy?
I bought a new set of Rogers, and I got those through Jim Lopez at B-Sharp Music, and he took very good care of me.
Okay. And speaking of musical equipment, what kind of bass are you playing at this time, Denny?
I'm playing a Guild. Well, actually, are we before the fire or after the fire? Well, actually, I was playing a Guild. I was playing a Guild the whole time, before and after.
What's Lonnie playing for a guitar?
Gibson, 335.
Okay.
He took his home that night. He didn't lose his in the fire.
Now, Denny, talking with you earlier, you said just by chance, in June of 1969, the band was traveling through Illinois and wanted to stop by and check out Blue Cheer at a concert. And something very interesting occurred. What's the story?
Yes, we were all on the road that time, which I mean by all is Dave Anthony was traveling with us. We were doing a bunch of shows through Iowa and Kansas area, and we came up into Illinois, and we knew that Blue Cheer was going to be playing at the Joliet Fairgrounds. So we'd pulled in there, and we wanted to see Blue Cheer play, and bought our tickets, parked our stuff outside, and walked in and sat down and waited and waited. And the opening act played, and they were done. And then we waited and waited. And Dave Anthony wanted to find out what was going on. So he went backstage and talked with the promoter. Said he was told that Blue Cheer had not shown up and didn't know where they were. So Dave Anthony says, well, I got my boys out here if you want them to play their three-piece band. So the guy says, I'll take anything at this point because I'm getting all the restless kids out there. So we ended up playing the job for Blue Cheer, or filling in for Blue Cheer, who didn't show up. And Pete, you want to elaborate on anything that happened at that point?
Well, it was surprising. We were really apprehensive as to just how the crowd would react to another three-piece group coming on. However, we explained the situation, started playing, and it went really well. And as we closed the set, we did do the Eddie Cochran song that they had recorded, and actually it went pretty well.
Yeah, Summertime Blues. Yeah, we did that.
Summertime Blues was their huge hit.
Yep.
Obviously, you were introduced as Joker's Wild.
Oh, yeah. We were all upright and straightforward about it. And
you made no attempt to pretend you were...
And I think my take, anyway, Denny might disagree with me, but my take was that the crowd was just thrilled that someone, after the silence, was up there and providing some music for them.
Yep. And they even offered to give people money back, but people, they didn't. They just stayed and had a good time.
Was that a freebie?
No, everybody paid to get in there.
Do you think some of the audience actually thought you were Blue Cheer?
I thought so. I mean, on a few people, they're saying, play your hit or play this, you know, they're yelling that. They didn't even hear us say that we were somebody else.
Had you played Summertime Blues before?
No.
Never? Well, how did you know how to play it?
It's a record song. Just knew the song. We could...
You know, that was one thing about being a three-piece group playing with Lonnie Knight that was fabulous. We could play a song that we've never rehearsed. If someone knew the words to it, we could do it. I can remember several occasions when Lonnie would turn around to the drums and say, we're going to play, and he'd spit out a song name and start counting 1, 2, 3, 4 for it to start.
And once it started, you just followed it.
I can remember Shapes of Things to Come one night. It just came out of nowhere. We'd never rehearsed the song, never played it before, and it was just, we're doing it, 1, 2, 3, 4, let's go.
I remember doing a show in Iowa where Lonnie came up with Hello Goodbye by the Beatles, and we did that song, and I went, wah, we did it.
Did the band ever think about recording a album?
Yes, we talked about doing an album. We actually started doing it on January 16th of 1969. We went to Mike Side Recording Studios, which was formerly Universal Audio, which was formerly K-Bank. That's what I said earlier, that it kept changing names. And we recorded a number of songs in the studio.
And these were originals now?
Yes. We actually did Peace Man and Tomorrow, which were a 45 that came out. And then we started working on other things that were going to be on that album.
How many total songs did you record?
We were going to record 14 songs and probably put 12 on the album. But I don't believe we ever got up to that high of a number. The band was booked so much, Dave and Anthony had so many jobs that we could never book the recording studio. And then when we'd have a day off, the studio wouldn't have a day off. So we had trouble getting back in there. I don't think we got back in there until, what, April or June? And
my memory from this session was we were in there to get as much done as quick as we could, and it didn't provide an opportunity to go back and redo or restart. It was pretty much get it on track, and what you get is what the final result will be, at least for the preliminary tracks.
And somewhere in here, you give a tape to a producer from New York?
Actually, we went back in the studio, I think, about 2 weeks later and did another tape of a lot of cover songs that was called Studio B. We did it in Studio B where we went in and played all the stuff live, and then we came back and did the overdub vocals on it. And that was the tape. We did two different tapes, and we sent that to New York to a producer.
What happened with that?
Probably not a whole lot. I don't know. Do you remember anything being done with that?
Well, actually, those were the tapes that were lost.
Yep.
And you found.
Yeah, we found them. But
decades later.
But those were also, David Anthony sent the Submaster to New York months before that. And I think that was done right at that third or fourth, it was done the fourth week of January.
I understand David Anthony started booking shows on Sunday nights at the Labor Temple. Did you play any of those?
Yes, we did. David Anthony wanted to move out of the booking promoter, out of the booking agent area and go into the promotion thing. So he ended up signing a contract with, the Labor Temple. And he had that booked for a couple of years for different shows. And he always brought bands in on Sunday night. Most of the bands were traveling through this area, played for a lot cheaper prices, and would love to play on Sunday night because it would picked up all the road costs. So he used to do all of his shows on Sunday night, which was nice because you didn't have to compete with the people on Friday night and Saturday night. And at that point, he had the band called Procol Harum from England coming in, and he asked us if we would open up the show for him. So we opened up the show for Procol Harum. That would have been like February 23rd of 69.
Pete, what do you recall about playing with Procol Harum? Anything in particular?
A couple of things that night. First off, we had a huge crowd, and the first night that we used a song that Lonnie had written where there was a lot of harmonica work. And Lonnie typically didn't play the harmonica. So to hear him do this harmonica solo in a original song for the first time was interesting. The crowd received it really well. But my biggest takeaway was just the Labor Temple was full.
Danny,
wall-to-wall people. It was just like an ocean of people in front of you. It was great, and everybody was really responsive to everything you played. I mean, it wasn't like, play something by Motown or that. It was just, they, no matter what you played, they loved it. It was great.
Procol Harum, of course, well-known for their...
Whiter Shade of Pale.
Whiter Shade of Pale, very popular song. And I understand David Anthony took the band back to Mike's Side Recording to record an album that was going to consist of 12 songs. And there was a contest to name the band's album. How did that go?
Well, we sent it out there, and after probably about a month, we decided to tally all the votes.
You advertised in a...
We advertised that, name the album. Every place we played, and we had Joker's Letters newsletter also that we mailed out back then to different places and different fans, and it was name the album. We got back a lot of different response. And this one guy out of Iowa, Storm Lake, Iowa, had said Liquid Giraffe, and we really liked that name. It just sounded so strange. It kind of fit us. So we chose that to be the name for Liquid Giraffe album. Unfortunately, we'd recorded like 8 or 9 songs, and the album was never finished, so it never came out at that point.
Now, that's the guy who submitted 2 typed pages with 95 potential names?
Yes, he did.
Didn't we run into him or make contact with him in recent years? I think somewhere on YouTube or somewhere he wrote a thing that says, hey, I'm that guy.
Did the band play in Storm Lake, Iowa?
Yes, we played the Cobblestone Ballroom down there. We were really popular. We packed the place, and it was actually our biggest place that we played. And Pete, you want to take over on this?
Well, David Anthony had the brilliance to work out a deal with the promoter where once the promoter got the $500 or whatever that he had to pay us, any money that was raised after that, we split 50-50. And we, on one particular night that I remember, had the ballroom full, the parking lot full, and one of our road managers actually counting people coming in. So we ended up with just a huge volume of dollars as a result of that. Dollar bills, literally. When we got back to the cities, this was back when everything was paid for in cash and every dollar had to be counted in the bank. So there these hippies were on Monday morning at the Camden Bank with all the suit and tie people waiting in line while the bank tellers counted thousands of $1 bills.
Thousands. Sounds pretty good for one night.
Multiple $1 bills in your drum case. We brought it in your drum case.
Well, we had the whole weekend's worth of money.
Yep.
It was thousands, I think, or $1,200 probably. Yeah. I don't know.
On average, what did Joker's Wild make on a show?
Back then, when we were three-piece, usually 350. I think 350, 450. And when we did the Cobblestone Ballroom, we were into the 8, 9, and 1,000 range, so it was great.
I understand the band played with Creedence Clearwater Revival.
Yeah, this was at the old Minneapolis Armory, just a little bit to the north of the Metrodome. I had 2 memories from that. First, it was pretty unique in that vehicles could actually drive up to the stage and offload. And secondly, Creedence Clearwater was there. And usually when you're working with other bands, they're warm and inviting and full of stories. And it's just great to talk to them, and they're pleasant. These guys were just very, very withdrawn and quiet. We didn't know at the time that there was a lot of turmoil in their world and a lot of tension. Clearly, we found them not to be the normal, warm, friendly folks that you typically play with.
Danny, do you know what was going on at the time?
At the time, it was a long process, but I know Tom and his brother were fighting. John Fogerty and Tom, the 2 brothers, they were fighting.
Any other Labor Temple shows that come to mind?
We were booked for the Albert King one with Skin Trade, but Albert King didn't show up.
Yeah.
So your third 45 comes out of the earlier recording sessions from Liquid Giraffe, correct?
Yes.
And what were the two songs that you picked?
That would have been Peace Man, written by Lonnie Knight, and Tomorrow, written by Pete Huber. Actually, both of them were submitted out there as sides to play, so that Peace Man went up the charts. Well, let's take Rochester, Minnesota, on KNCV FM. They played Peace Man, and that went up the charts to number one, sat there for a few weeks and went down, and then they flipped it over, and Tomorrow, written by Pete Huber, went up to number one and sat there and then came down. It was great to have a flip 45, which not too many people ever get, because a lot of bands back then used to put an instrumental on side two just to fill it. They were pushing the one song.
And how about in the Twin Cities, Pete?
We got minimal airplay here, sorry to say.
So now this is the first song of yours that gets recorded.
Yes.
And the first time you get to sing.
Yes.
So what was that like for you?
Well, it was good for me. Those that had to hear me sing may have argued with that, but it was a song just about a boyfriend-girlfriend situation.
And this is also back at Universal Audio?
Yes.
Yep.
With Bob Schultz again?
Yes. Bob Schultz lived there.
And did you have a producer?
Tony Glover.
And he was?
He was the night DJ on KQRS, and he was hired by Dave Anthony to come in and produce a single for us.
So now on your third 45, are you happier with the quality?
Oh, the quality was a lot better. I mean, we went to Universal Audio, and they just switched to 8-track Scully. So we had 8 tracks. So we gave the drums 4 tracks, and then from then on we went up, and the clarity of the recording was just unbelievable compared to 4-track. We didn't have any really good luck bouncing things down in tracks, you know, when you did the 4-track. But the 8-track was a lot better for us.
What do you think explains the popularity of the record in Rochester?
I have no idea, but it was just great down there. We played the Rochester Ballroom down there. I remember the Rochester Arena. Isn't that what it was called? The Rochester...
Rochester Mayo...
Mayo Auditorium. There we go.
Mayo Auditorium.
The Rochester Mayo Auditorium. We played that. And I remember Thunder Tree opened up for us, and we did a thing down there at Donaldson's, where we were rode in a parade, and we were celebrities.
Bundy?
Yeah, Bill Bundy was the DJ. He had us down there, and we rode in the parade and waved to people. We did the autograph party at Donaldson's, and then after that, we went out to the radio station to become guest DJs.
So you were rock stars for a day.
Yes.
In Rochester.
Our 15 minutes of fame. And down there, I mean, letting those mics loose to us with 3 smart-ass guys on there. And I remember, was it you, Pete, or Lonnie, that said, tonight the freeze warnings are coming in. It's like 100 degrees outside in the summertime. Also, he says, cover your plants tonight because we got a freeze warning. And just all kinds of little goofy things like that. It was terrific.
What's the band using at this point in time for a band vehicle?
At that time, we had 2 vans. We had a Ford extended van, which carried equipment in it, and then we had the other van with the windows in it, the window van. We had 2. And the funny is, the band got smaller, we got bigger.
Did the band have a bus at one point?
Yes, we did have a bus at one point. We had I think it was a 42-passenger bus at one point.
Where'd you get that from?
We bought that from some little company in Shakopee. We wanted to get a big bus, but Dave Anthony took us down to Nashville to show us all the big buses that everybody had, but we found out they were $100,000, and we had to curl our tail between our legs and come back and buy a school bus for like $3,000 or whatever.
But I will admit, I thought we had died and gone to heaven. We had a place that all the equipment could fit comfortably in the back, and up in the front we all had a spot for ourselves, and we converted it so that there were tables in the front, and it sure brought a level of comfort to travel that we didn't have before. And back then we'd put 100,000 miles a year on a vehicle.
You're talking about the converted school bus?
Yes.
Okay. And that eventually got sold to another band, right?
Thunder Tree.
How did you wind up in Kelker Junction, Colorado Springs, Colorado?
We ended up in Kelker Junction. That was on our way down to Albuquerque, New Mexico, where we were going to line up with, as you remember, a little earlier, we did a show with Creedence Clearwater Revival. Dave Anthony connected with their manager, and they said that they were going to be doing a southern tour of all, like, Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, all that stuff for them. They were going to do a southern tour, and they needed an opening act. They enjoyed working with us that night at Minneapolis Armory and asked if we were interested in opening up for them. So the show was supposed to start at a certain time, and we ended up going down a little bit early because Dave Anthony had booked some jobs in Kansas City. He booked them in Kelker Junction, which is Colorado Springs, Colorado, and then Albuquerque and those areas. So we ended up at Kelker Junction opening a show for Canned Heat. The place was just super packed, and that was one of those places where we went out there, we were on top of our game that night. We did a great show, and we had three ovations.